Accession number 10293, Rule 3.
Smith, Reel 3. He had to have a set of switches as well so he could break in on the frequencies to give instructions. And so the only way I could do that was by a system of relays. And there were no relays available which would do what I needed to be done. And I had to go down to the equipment stores and take out there all different types of relays, break them down into basic components, and rebuild new sets of relays to fit my purpose, to make this system work. And that was the only time really I had a problem. The rest of the time, no. I had some good people working for me. The CEO was a very good chappy. I had a wonderful working relationship with the warrant officer engineer, because he was a warrant officer engineer, I was a warrant officer signals. And the two of us were great pals. And in the hangar, we worked hand in glove with each other. And we were able to, you know, do the job smoothly without any worries. We were special. We know that. And so we virtually got what we wanted.
Were you aware of the work that the Pathfinders were doing at that particular time?
Yes.
Or
yes.
Have you really learned more about it since the war?
No, I think we knew exactly what they were doing at the time because we had to... We built this trainer to teach them. So we knew exactly what they had to do and how they had to do it. And the whole... If you'd walked into that room whilst a raid was in progress... An artificial raid in that room was in progress. I am told that it was 100% authentic. That it really, the photographs that were taken of it were just the same as photographs taken over Germany. Because everything was spot on. We had targets on the ground that were made of exactly some specific place in Germany. The mountains, the railways, the goods yards, the trees, everything was exactly the same as that place in Germany. Then on the revolving table, through a system of contacts, rotating contacts, we had little lights so that when the marker said, drop to white TI, a little white light would come at a certain spot on the target that looked like a target indicator actually burning on the target. If he said it was a red one, there was a red light. If he said a green one, there was a green light. If he said, I want the white one cancelled with a red, then a red one would come out to cancel the white one. And then he'd say, put a green one on there, and put a green one there, and a green light would come out. And those lights that came on that revolving target, and it was revolving so that it looked as though the aircraft were going round it, whereas in actual fact, of course, the target was revolving, and the aircraft was stationary because it was just a little room built on the side of a wall. When they dropped their bombs, there were puffs of smoke and explosions came off the table because they had little fuses wired in with little explosive devices there. Puffs of smoke came up, clouds of smoke came up, red lights came up for fires burning. There were very small bulbs, about no more than a quarter of an inch in length, on wires up above the target. And they used to flash on and off to, that was flak. You were flying through flak then because the lights were exploding right away around the whole room. It was pitch black. And everything was exactly the same as over a target. Guns firing, flak in the air, target indicators, targets burning, smoke. By the time we finished one of those exercises, the target would be obliterated with smoke, the same as it would be if you dropped real bombs. And they say that it was exactly as it was over a target. So we knew how a master bomber went in. We knew how the master mosquitoes went in to back up his target indicators, how he went in to assess it. We used to hear him. We could hear his instructions because times we would be down there to listen to it. Then we'd hear the master, the pathfinders themselves go in. After the 627 mosquitoes had been in, the pathfinders go in and mark it and then leave it for the main force to go in after that. So we had the whole setup. We had to know the setup to some extent to build the unit to make it fit. And then once we'd got it working, it had to work the right way. So we had to know what happened over target. So we knew the people who did that job. There was myself on the radio. I did the radio personally. There was a flight sergeant electrician who did the electrical work. There was a sergeant WAF who did the target work and an instrument maker. You know, we built that trainer. We knew how it worked because we had to know. We knew how it worked because we knew had to know how to make it work that way, if you can see my point. Without knowing the end product, we couldn't have built the trainer to do its job. And then, of course, once it was in use and they were training people up, sometimes we'd go down just to listen in, and sometimes if maybe there's a fault on something, we'd go down and listen throughout and see what the fault was and sort of, you know, put the fault right. So we knew exactly what.
But in the period that you were working on this trainer, mm-hmm. did not the techniques of pathfinding and marking change so that you had to alter the trainer?
No. Ours was the change. We made the change. That trainer was the change in the tactics that was used for the rest of the war.
But once you got it set up...
Once we got it set up, yes.
Did they not say, right, we've decided to change this, that and the other?
I don't think there were many changes on it, no. I can't remember any changes on it, really, because the plan was there and it worked. Whoever evolved the plan in the first place evolved the plan which would work. We just had to build a trainer to make it work and train the people to make it work, and it did.
Did you get visits from any of the VIPs, like Air Vice Marshal Bennett or Ralph Cochran?
I can't remember any of those people. I was just there that Bennett would come down because we were pathfinders, yes. But remember, as a warrant officer then, I was a very lowly cog in the wheel. The one chap who did come down one time to see us was Barney Wallace, who of course had done the Dam Buster one in any case. And Barney came down. I remember meeting Barney at that time. If there was any of the really top big nebbies came down, you know, the bigwigs come down, then, of course, they would be met by the group captain. And, of course, my boss was squadron leader, who was in charge of the signals on the whole station. And, of course, he would be in the party, but I wouldn't.
Who was he?
Squadron leader Wilcott.
Wilcott?
Wilcott.
And who was the group captain?
I think at that time it was Evans, one of the two brothers. There was two brothers, group captain Evans. He was always called Evans Squared. I think he was the group captain at the time.
What impression did Barnes Wallace make on you? What did he look like and so on?
A very quietish chap in a way. I suppose typical of a boffin. Just quietly got on with his job, found out what he wanted to find out and did what he wanted to do. And knew what he was doing. He was a very clever chap, was Barney Wallace. Very clever chap. I mean, the things that he's invented, there's no one's business. And very nice to talk to. Just a good chap who was a good worker, a good, brilliant brain.
What was his physical appearance?
To me, he seemed a little slightly stooped back, fairly thicker set. His hair seemed to be a bit longer than usual, and a bit of a rugged face, and cheery face. But that's about all I can remember of him, I always think, you know.
What was the purpose of his visit?
Well, we weren't told things like that.
But what other things was he asking about?
Well, he just came round and sort of just general inspection and saw what type of work we were doing. He went across to the trainer, but of course I wasn't with them when they went to the trainer. So maybe he had something, you know, special down there on the training side, I don't know. It certainly didn't come under my jurisdiction, that bit. I was only a warrant officer.
Did you say you came across Guy Gibson?
Yes.
Under what circumstances was that?
Well, Guy Gibson, of course, left the squadron about the time I joined it, because he went to America to do this trip to America, you know, this publicity trip in America. Then when he came back, he, of course, was one of our four master bombers. And our master bombers used to fly a Mosquito. But Guy Gibson was something special, and he had an American Lightning, a P-54 Lightning, the old twin boom, twin fuselage job. And Guy Gibson, that was his special aircraft. And I modified that aircraft especially for Guy Gibson, because all radio equipment in aircraft is on low impedance.
Is that what?
Low impedance, low resistance wiring, or low resistance earpieces and speakers and things like that. But Guy Gibson, being special, had to have a high impedance one in his aircraft so that nobody else could use it. Nobody else
Why
used
was that?
I don't know, but nobody used Guy Gibson's aircraft except himself, because he was the only one with a high impedance set of earphones. He had a high-low set. So he could get into an ordinary aircraft and switch to low and put it on a high impedance and switch it to high.
You mean he had some kind of possessiveness?
No, he was a god, I suppose. He was a god after what he'd done. So I don't know if it was his idea or anybody else's idea, but I know I modified his aircraft, because he came to my office in the hangar one lunchtime and he said, "How's my aircraft getting on?" And I said, "Very well, thank you, sir. It'll be ready for you in a couple of days." He said, "Good. Nice on low impedance." I said, "No, sir, high impedance." He said, "Low impedance." I said, "No, sir, high impedance." And he said, "Don't you work on that aircraft anymore," he said. "I want it on low impedance." I said, "No, sir, you want it on high impedance. Everybody else has got low impedance. You want it on high impedance." And he said, "Leave it. I'm going to check." And this was lunchtime. "I'll see the squadron leader," he said, "and have this sorted out." I was late going to lunch, so I was late back from lunch. I should have been back in my office at 1:30. It was 10 to 2 when I got back. And Guy Gibson was sitting in my office at 1:30, waiting for me to come back. And I walked in, and he said, "I have come to apologize, warrant officer, because," he said, "I should not have questioned the technical ability of a technical warrant officer." He said, "You are quite right. I was wrong. I made a mistake. I'm sorry." Now, for a wing commander, if he's standing to come back to apologize and sit there waiting for me, I thought was the gesture of a great man. How many people would have done that? Because I don't know many others who would have done it. So but he came back to admit that he was wrong.
Why do you think he was so... He said low impedance in the first place?
It just got in his mind. It just got in his mind, that was all. It was just probably used to having low impedance in his mind. But he made a mistake, but he was man enough to come back and apologise to a warrant officer. And Guy Gibson, who had a worldwide reputation, sailed the Danpas to BC, and he took sufficient time to come back and sit in a warrant officer's office to apologise when he came in. And I thought that was the gesture of a great man.
So what was your response?
I just thanked him for, you know, having the decency to come back and saying, you know, it's okay, so, you know.
What did he look like?
What did he look like? He wasn't a really tall chap, just about the average height, thick set, dark head. Very smooth looking chap. But he obviously knew his worth and had a sort of air of superiority and authority about him.
What do you mean by smooth? I suppose. Sure.
No, his manner, he was suave. He was a top dog and he knew it. And if he wanted something, he was going to get it. But he had good ways of getting it, sort of thing, I suppose. That it wasn't a direct order, you will do it, but the way he put it, it was just the same sort of thing.
So this was at Coningsby?
That was at Coningsby. And then...
Whereabouts on the base was the mock-up?
In the... what used to be an armoury and photographic section in the middle of the camp. Big building where we took over this part and transformed it to the use that we required of it.
Are there any other memories of those days, wartime days at Coningsby, that you can recount?
No, I think during that period it was a time when air crew were working hard, there was a hell of a lot to do, and it was a question of, from my own point of view, keeping the base going to get all the new aircraft out. And then at night going out and down to the local pub and enjoying oneself and having a good nosh and a booze up, I suppose.
Were you and your comrades on the base following the offensive, the strategic bombing offensive against Germany?
Yes, I think we were, because we had a sort of direct hand in it, in as much as that we were training these crews for doing the job. So we knew, you know, the day after sort of thing, what target they'd been to and what had happened virtually over the target and how they got on with it. So we had a pretty good idea, yes.
Do any of the raids stand out in your mind then?
No, not really. Not really. I would think that the one thing possibly about any raids that stand out in my mind was when 617 went to do the first big dam after the main dams. And we sent 13 aircraft out that night. And they didn't get to the target. And I think we got 5 back. We lost 8 just going across there to try and do something. And I would think possibly that's the only thing. Otherwise, no, it was a question of they went out and the next day some chap that probably you knew particularly well wasn't there anymore.
So what was morale like on the base?
Very good. It was a terrific base. You had good squadrons there. You had special squadrons. It was special people. Secrecy was absolutely 100%. And so was comradeship and l'esprit de corps. It was